Tuesday, May 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Thanks very much for joining us. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry tries to contain the widening violence in Syria.
Both sides, the opposition and the regime, have contributed to this chaos.
Also ahead, an anti-poaching conference in Kenya vows to protect elephants, and we hear how the late performer Prince wrote a song for country music star Kenny Rogers. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry wrapped up a hastily planned 20-hour visit to Geneva Monday, saying the United States and its partners are discussing several proposals to stop the spiraling violence in Syria.
Both sides, the opposition and the regime, have contributed to this chaos. And we are working over these next hours intensely in order to try to restore the cessation of hostilities and at the same time to raise the level of accountability that will accompany the day-to-day process of implementing this ceasefire. To that effect, Russia and the United States have agreed that there will be additional personnel who will work from here in Geneva on a daily basis, 24/7, in order to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in order to try to make sure that there is a better job and a better ability to be able to enforce the cessation of hostilities day to day.
Secretary Kerry's intention has been to try to restore a partial truce and stop the attacks by Russian-backed Syrian government forces that have killed hundreds in Aleppo over the past 11 days. Meanwhile, Arab media are reporting more violence in Syria's largest city, Aleppo, along with militant attacks on the desert oasis town of Deir ez-Zor. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Allahu Akbar!
Shelling and airstrikes pummeled targets on government and rebel sides of Syria's largest city, Aleppo, for the 11th day since a two-month-old ceasefire agreement began to break down.
42 اصابه اسعفت الى مشفى الرازي. 6 منهم شهداء تم احالتهم مباشره.
Syrian state TV, quoting medical sources, reported 6 civilians were killed and 40 wounded in government-held western districts of Aleppo after rebel militias fired rockets, mortars, and artillery. During the broadcast, the Jabhat al-Nusra group was accused of indiscriminately raining terror on civilian areas. The head of the opposition Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, Rami Abdulrahman, accused Syrian government forces of targeting opposition-held areas in the east and north of Aleppo. He says government forces attacked the Castello Road resupply route into the rebel side of the city, as well as striking several northern suburbs with barrel bombs. He added government forces are trying to advance from the oasis town of Palmyra toward the eastern city of Deir ez-Zor. Sky News Arabia reported government forces in Deir ez-Zor had come under heavy attack from Islamic State militants. Russian and Syrian government warplanes responded by striking militant targets around the city. The fighting took place as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met in Geneva with United Nations Syria envoy Stephane de Mistura and Saudi Foreign Minister Adel al-Jubeir. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov remained in Moscow, where de Mistura hopes to meet with him Tuesday. De Mistura said efforts are being made to resume and bolster the fraying ceasefire.
We are preparing the mechanism, much better mechanism for monitoring and controlling a new ceasefire reinvigorated. But we need political will for that.
Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV said the Syrian government was massing forces in the Aleppo district of Al-Masharika for a new offensive against rebel forces. Qatari-owned Al Jazeera TV reported the Syrian government was trying to cut the supply route into the opposition-held side of the city and lay siege to it. VOA could not independently confirm the reports. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Among the world's top stories, the Islamic State is eradicating poppy crops in Afghanistan. The chief of the U.S. Navy calls for normalized relations with Russia and the Baltics. The owner of a collapsed building in Kenya is arrested, and voters in Indiana prepare to cast ballots in presidential primaries. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Attended and supported by three African presidents, a three-day anti-poaching summit has concluded in Kenya. The event resulted in $5 million in pledges and a united message to the world that elephants are worth more alive than dead. VOA's Jill Craig attended the summit that culminated with the largest ivory burn in history.
Elephants are iconic symbols of Africa, but the poaching crisis across the continent puts their existence in jeopardy. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta says their deaths represent a blow to his country's heritage. Kenyatta and the presidents of Uganda and Gabon came together at the Giants Club summit in Kenya to pledge their support to saving the African elephant, of which tens of thousands are killed every year for their ivory tusks. Save the Elephant's founder, Ian Douglas Hamilton, says this high-level commitment is key.
Ultimately, a lot of decisions in Africa get taken at presidential level. If the president is not behind a movement, it's just not going to happen.
The three-day summit, organized by elephant conservation group Space for Giants, also hosted conservationists, diplomats, celebrities, and others to find solutions to the poaching crisis. Donors and financiers pledged more than $5 million for elephant protection initiatives in Kenya, Gabon, Uganda, and Botswana. Funds will go toward increasing frontline protection, improving technological and legal capabilities, building electrified fences, and setting up an endowment fund for protected areas. John Abor is a legal specialist and trainer for Space for Giants.
I believe that this is going to send a message to the rest of Africa, especially the places where wildlife are. They are going to see what the president of Gabon, the president of Kenya, the president of Uganda have done.
Others, like wildlife investigator Rod Potter, are hopeful but hesitant about the summit's outcomes.
Yes, I do think something will come out of it. Whether it's as big as we would like to see, probably not.
At Kenya's ivory burn Saturday, in which 105 tons of elephant ivory and 1 1/3 tons of rhino horn were destroyed, Kenyatta pledged his support for a complete ban on the ivory trade. WildAid CEO Peter Knights explains why he and many other conservationists are against the selling of ivory.
We've tried this two times. In the 1980s, we were trying to sell ivory legally under a regulated trade. We lost half of Africa's elephants. It went from 1.3 million to 600,000 elephants. We stopped the trade in 1989, and the poaching went down. And then again, we tried again in 2009. They sold 70 tons to China, and suddenly the poaching went up again to 33,000. So you can't put this back on the market, just like you can't put heroin back on the market.
The summit and the ivory burn concluded with this unified message to the world. Ivory has no worth, while living elephants have enormous value. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Salih saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump faces a crucial showdown in the Indiana primary Tuesday with his closest rival, Texas Senator Ted Cruz. A Trump victory in Indiana would likely put him on a glide path to clinching the Republican Party's presidential nomination before the July National Convention in Cleveland. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview of Tuesday's showdown from Washington.
A victory in Tuesday's Indiana primary would put an increasingly confident Donald Trump on the verge of wrapping up the Republican Party's presidential nomination.
It's really important that we win, because if we win, you know, we want to raise money for the party. We want to raise money for the Senate races and for the congressional races and do a lot of things instead of wasting our time with these people.
Trump is coming off 5 easy primary victories in the East last week, and a win in Indiana would deal a major blow to his top rival, Senator Ted Cruz. But Cruz is not backing down, pressing for a victory that could deny Trump the number of delegates he needs to avoid a contested Republican convention in July.
I'm not getting to 1,237 delegates, and Donald J. Trump is not getting to 1,237 delegates. And the Hoosier State is going to have a powerful voice in making that clear.
You people, you're going to be sick and tired of winning.
Despite his lead, Trump continues to face protests, including this one last week in California, where he spoke at a Republican gathering. A victory in Indiana would put Trump one step closer to a much-needed first ballot victory at the convention, says analyst John Fortier.
And so Donald Trump, I think, feels he has to win on that first ballot, either outright with the 1,237 by winning them in the votes or by getting close and persuading a few others. If it goes to ballot 2 or 3, he's potentially in some trouble.
Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton is also campaigning in Indiana, fresh off winning 4 of 5 primaries last week. Clinton is already focusing on Trump as her likely opponent in the general election.
Mr. Trump accused me of playing the, quote, woman card. Well, if fighting for women's health care and paid family leave and equal pay is playing the woman card, then deal me in.
Clinton is in a tight race in Indiana with rival Bernie Sanders, who vows to fight on through the rest of the upcoming primaries.
We believe that we are in a very strong position to win many of these remaining contests, and we have an excellent chance to win in California, the state with far and away the most delegates.
But time is running out for Sanders, as Clinton has built a virtually insurmountable lead in her quest for the Democratic nomination. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Turning now to our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio with what's buzzing online. Hi, G.
Hi, Sarah.
Well, let's start with a short clip of Carly Fiorina.
Let's do that. She's in Indiana with GOP presidential contender Ted Cruz, and here is what the trending video shows. She was at an event introducing a running mate, Cruz, on stage, but suddenly stumbled out of the view looking like she fell off the stage. That was caught on camera, and what was also captured is Cruz still shaking hands with other people on stage as she's falling.
Yikes. Well, what's the public reaction like online?
Many Twitter users found it quite funny, but some people did show concern for her safety and the media coverage of the event. One user tweeted, "Not going to lie, I'm a little disappointed reports have left out whether Carly Fiorina is actually okay after a stumble." Others say it's a metaphor for the Cruz campaign. A local radio host tweeted, "Carly falling off stage, a child telling Cruz he sucks, Heidi calling Ted an immigrant. The hashtag INPrimary is not Team Cruz's finest hour."
That's a hashtag we'll be seeing a lot in the next 24 hours.
That's right.
Well, what else is trending?
President Obama's daughter, Malia, is trending after getting accepted to Harvard University. The White House announced she would take a year off before going off to college. And Sarah, that seems to be an increasingly popular thing for high school graduates to do.
Yeah, I've heard about they do that, I think, in the UK quite a bit. I think Prince William did that before he started university. I wish I'd had that option in my day.
I didn't have that option either. And here are some of the comments to that news on Facebook. One person wrote, "Taking a gap year is the smartest thing a young mind transitioning from high school to college could possibly do." But another person wrote, "If this was a white guy from a Wall Street family, the media would label it, quote-unquote, privileged." That's all for me today. Sarah?
Many thanks, G. That's our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well, at VOA Williams. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter, at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Many dog owners like to show affection by hugging them. But a recent article in Psychology Today indicates that giving Fido a hug may not be such a good idea. The article, written by Stanley Coren, a psychology professor and author of several books on dog behavior, suggests that you really shouldn't hug dogs because it raises their stress and anxiety levels. Coren looked at 250 random pictures of people or their children hugging their dogs and looked for signs that indicated the dog wasn't happy being hugged. Those signs include dogs who turn their head away, close their eyes, lower the ears, or their slick back against the side of their head. Other signs of a dog's stress and anxiety can include yawning, licking his lips, or even licking your face. Rather than showing fondness for your dog with a hug, Coren suggests that you give your pet a pat, a kind word, or maybe a treat. Good dog. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. People who are interested in solar energy but don't own the perfect roof on which to install solar panels may have another option in parts of the United States, the United Kingdom, and Germany. They can buy into a bigger, centrally located project. These are called shared solar or community solar. There's a boomlet of such projects in half a dozen U.S. states. But as Tom Bancy reports, wider adoption still appears dependent on government support or regulatory changes.
Single mother Chris Anderson says she looked into adding some kind of renewable energy to her home in Shelton, Washington, but it was daunting. Then last year, the electric company in her area invited customers to invest in a shared solar array on the roof of the utility's operations center.
This opportunity is easy. I mean, it's literally the easy button. Okay, here's my check. But I'm doing a good thing.
Anderson is one of thousands of people around the United States who've bought shares in a community solar project developed either by their utility or a local nonprofit. Justin Holsgrove of Mason County Public Utility District Number 3 leads me onto the roof to see the project Anderson and friends bought into.
So, glad you brought your sunglasses. It's nice and bright up here, which is perfect for solar.
Holsgrove says his utility and some others around the state had to turn people away.
We had twice as many people register for solar units than we had solar units available. So there was a lot of interest in this.
And then what kind of payback period did you promise investors?
Yeah, so we promised a 3 to 4 year payback period. We estimated, would probably be a better word, we estimated a 3 to 4 year payback period, which is fantastic. When you're looking at putting a rooftop solar system on your own home, a private home, you're looking at a 10 to 15, maybe even a 20 year payback period, depending on, you know, your site's location.
The math generally works out like this. The utility pays participants for their share of the electricity produced, usually as a credit on their bill. In addition, a government subsidy or tax credit may be offered. That incentive happens to be quite generous in Washington state. In states with low electricity rates and no solar subsidies, though, the communal approach has proven a tough sell because investors may not ever break even over the life of a project. But a selling point everywhere for participants is avoiding the hassles of building or maintaining their own solar array.
Solar power and rooftop solar is very, very popular right now. However, there are a lot of barriers to get into a solar power system on your house. There are, maybe you don't own your own home, maybe you're renting or leasing, perhaps your roof is in poor shape and you need to take care of that first. In beautiful Mason County, you might be surrounded with fir trees.
The National Renewable Energy Laboratory estimates at least half of U.S. households are not suited for on-site solar. But the government's researchers say the growth potential for communal solar projects is great. Senior analyst David Feldman was the lead author on a recent report.
It obviously opens up the market dramatically. It also has a lot more potential for community support, and it's something that a lot of utilities can get behind because they're not cut out of the energy-producing process like what occurs on on-site PV systems.
Feldman points to a variety of barriers that stand in the way of community solar reaching its full potential. Those include unfamiliarity with the concept and all manner of red tape that comes from the involvement of regulated utilities, government agencies, customer contracts, and multi-party financing.
If utilities or regulators don't support this type of arrangement, then it's very difficult for these businesses to come about because there's no way for the economics to work.
Feldman says when you look at where community solar is catching on, it's obvious what a difference the level of government support makes. Shared solar arrays are concentrated not in the sunniest U.S. states, but in those that passed specific enabling laws, such as Massachusetts, Minnesota, Colorado, and Washington. Despite impressive growth in recent years, solar accounts for only about 1% of U.S. electricity generation today. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Shelton, Washington.
The late performer Prince was primarily known for his rock, soul, and funk-infused grooves, but did you know he also dabbled in country music? Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to give us another glimpse into the rich legacy of his royal purple badness. Well, so Nikki, does Prince have a country album hidden in his secret vault of unreleased music?
I think he probably does. He probably does, but right now we can't say for sure because it's still locked up. But one thing we do know is that Prince could excel in any genre he put his mind to and frequently did. And during his entire life, he dabbled in other genres under different pseudonames. One of those names is Joey Coco.
So he wrote for Kenny Rogers under that name, didn't he?
Yes, exactly. So Kenny was one of the artists he wrote for under that name. He wrote the song You're My Love that Kenny recorded for his 1986 album They Don't Make Them Like They Used To. And he also wrote Telepathy for country artist Deborah Allen.
So how did he and Kenny Rogers get together?
Okay, well, Kenny Rogers had been a big fan of Prince, like the rest of the world. And in the 80s, Kenny said he contacted Prince through a mutual friend and asked if he would write him a song. And Prince actually did. And on his Facebook page, Kenny Rogers says that when he sent the song to me, if I remember right, it was him playing all of the instruments on it and he had his background vocals on it. He said, unfortunately, on the finished record, somehow my producer didn't end up using the music or vocals. The song was recut. He then goes on to say, it was such an incredible thing that Prince took the time to do that for me. He was a brilliant guy and a gifted musician with a lot of feelings. And you could tell his feelings went far deeper than what was written on his face.
That's You're My Love by Kenny Rogers, written by Joey Coco, also known as Prince.
Yes, that is the song. And I will be playing that track in full this week on Country Hits USA in tribute.
Oh, great. Well, you can hear Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music or Twitter at VOA_music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
You want to know if I care for you? You ought to know.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition here on The Voice of America. Stay tuned for the latest world news. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daryl Smith, I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Have a great Tuesday. We'll be right back.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
May 3rd is World Press Freedom Day. This day of observance was established by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, to raise awareness of the importance of press freedom. This year, UNESCO is highlighting the fact that a free and independent media are crucial to human advancement and development. At this time of turbulence and change across the world, including new challenges that require global cooperation and action, the need for quality information has never been so important, said Director General of UNESCO Irina Bokova. This requires a strong environment of press freedom and well-functioning systems to ensure the people's right to know. Yet, over the past several years, in every part of the world, we see an accelerating trend by both state and non-state actors to stifle media and internet freedom. According to the recently issued State Department country reports on human rights, in too many countries, governments crack down on the fundamental freedoms of expression and association by jailing reporters for writing critical stories, and they did so in numerous and varied ways. Some passed new laws or used existing laws to selectively persecute, harass, intimidate, and prosecute journalists, independent media, and bloggers critical of the sitting regime or its actions. Others chose to view criticism as a targeted insult and chose to prosecute journalists under new or existing, frequently vaguely worded laws against insulting the head of state or the government. Elsewhere, a government used anti-terror and insult laws to prosecute journalists and to either drive opposition media outlets out of business or to bring them under state control. And so, on this day, let us remember the crucial role that free media play in keeping society free and healthy. Let us stand up in support of journalists under threat and of media in danger of being censored or shut down. And remember those journalists who lost their lives while exercising their profession. The world must unite in the global campaign to end impunity for crimes committed against journalists, since some 90% of crimes committed against journalists have gone unprosecuted, and less than 7% of cases in which journalists have been killed have been resolved. Far from threatening the democratic process, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry in his preface to this year's Human Rights Report, a free press and open civil society are the release valve and lifeblood of a thriving democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours.